Thanks. So I will talk about linker-assisted aggregation from a theoretical point of view. This is work that I've been doing as a postdoc at UCLA with Bill Gelbart, Andrea Liu, and Robin Bruinsma. And I will also describe some molecular dynamic simulations that have been done by Kunchun Lee, who's a graduate student in our group, and on which we are collaborating with Mark Stevens from Sandia National Laboratories. The motivation to study this, the theoretical aspect of this aggregation, comes from many biological systems where semi-flexible filaments tend to aggregate in various forms, and two of the main filaments that tend to aggregate are DNA and actin, and we heard a lot about both in this meeting. And the forms in which they aggregate are have a wide variety. For example, they can form all kinds of networks, and they also can form some kind of bundles, and I will give a few examples of these. And in particular, in some cases, you can see that bundles coexist with networks. And one of the questions that we want to understand is under what conditions we will see bundles and under what conditions we will see networks, and how does the presence of the linkers control the structure of the filament network. There are many systems, and there are many what we call linkers that can induce these aggregations. This can be either polyvalent counterions, and there's a lot of discussion in recent years about electrostatic mechanisms for this aggregation. The same aggregations can also be formed by linker proteins, and actin has a very long list of proteins that are known to induce the formation of different structures. And it turns out that there are many common features to these different types of condensing agents. So we will basically talk about a kind of generic linker, and this linker could be either a polyvalent counterion or a linker protein. I will focus on two examples which will highlight two aspects of the aggregation question. So the idea is to look at simpler systems, because the big system is complicated, and try to see different how different properties interplay with each other. Actually, I will start with the second example. In this example, we will look at aggregation of two highly charged semi-flexible chains in the presence of these linkers, and we would like to understand how does under what conditions this chain would like to complexate together, and what would be the structure of the combined two-chain complex. The second example that I will describe is what happens when you have a relatively high concentration of rigid rods, which are in the pneumatic phase, and I will describe the properties of this phase later. And when you take this solution and you add linkers, so when you add a large amount of linkers, the rods will aggregate and form a tightly bound bundle. And the question is, what kind of structures can emerge at intermediate amounts of linkers? In both cases, we will focus on the linkers rather than the chains. So in many studies of these systems, people ask, how does the presence of the linkers modify the effective interaction between linkers, between the chains? This is especially true when people study the electrostatic interactions and the role of fluctuations and correlation. We do something different. We ask, how does the presence of the chains modify the interaction between the linkers? And the idea is that basically these interactions are the crucial ones that determine the structure of the system. And so by focusing on the linkers, we can determine which structure the system will favor. This will be an example of a many filament system, and we'll see how the cooperative interaction of or the cooperative presence of the many filaments determines the structure of the system. This will be a simpler system because we have only two chains, but on the other hand, we will see how the bending rigidity of the chains competes with the electrostatic interactions. Before I start to describe these models, let me introduce the main players in the game, the filaments, and I'm sure you are familiar with all of this, but this will give me an excuse for introducing the main physical properties that will be used in the model. So DNA is considered a semi-flexible chain because it is very, very long because it has to carry the genetic information. And on length scale, on global length scale, it looks flexible. But if you look at a very short length scales, you cannot bend it to a curvature that is smaller than 50 nanometers. And this 50 nanometers is the persistent length of DNA, which can be defined as the length you have to go along the filaments before you lose correlations to the original orientation. F-actin, on the other hand, has a persistent length that is large compared to the filament length. The filament length can be of the order of hundreds nanometers to microns, while the persistent length is of the order of microns. And so if you look globally at an actin filament, it looks quite rigid. Both DNA and F-actin are highly charged. The charge density, the linear charge density on DNA is one charge every 1.7 angstrom, while on F-actin it is one charge every 2.5 angstrom. This charge density can be expressed in a dimensionless parameter, the Manning parameter, psi, which is the ratio between the Bierum length and the average distance between charges. This number basically tells us if we have a highly charged filament, what is the electrostatic energy of a monovalent counterion close to the filament in units of the thermal energy KT. So whenever this parameter is much larger than one, this means that electrostatic interactions are strong. The condensing agents that can lead to the aggregation of DNA and F-actin are, in the case of DNA, polyvalent counterions of valency 3, 4, and above, although there are some special cases where divalent counterions can also induce aggregation. And for F-actin, these are counterions of valency 2 and above, and also a long list of actin-binding proteins. Seven angstrom for aqueous solutions in room temperature. The And also it also depends on the skinning length, because the skinning length kind of tends to smear out electrostatics, because it means that the skinning length is 1 nanometer. This means that each charge is kind of smeared out by the cloud of counterions in solution, and so the effect of the fact that the charges are located, for example, along a helix, is smeared out. But with DNA, for example, there are some calculations of the effect of this quite ordered structure of the charges. Okay, so
it looks more like interacting surfaces rather than.
Yeah, so we're somewhere in this kind of
Yeah, okay, so, the, so, 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 so for one thing, what you can, what, if you look at the cylinder from far away, you could say that the fact that it's a finite radius cylinder and not a linear charge means that you have to renormalize the bare charge on the cylinder. This adds to another renormalization that you have to do, which is due to the Manning condensation. And I mean, people understand quite relatively well how do you have to renormalize the charge on an isolated rod, but it's not obvious what happens when two rods come together. Do you have to take the bare charge or the renormalized charge or something in between? So what we will do in the model, we will have this effective Manning parameter psi, and one could choose different values for that depending on, do you think you should use the isolated rod regime or the coupled one?
It's actually been surprising that you can predict things pretty well just on this linear, you know, Manning parameter. It's not wildly off. So I don't understand why that works. Experimentally, it seems to be
that. I mean, arguably, it makes some sense to think about rock DNA, but no sense at all for active. The screening length is 1 nanometer, and the chain is almost 10 nanometers in diameter.
Yes, so in fact what is important is the ratio between, when you have Manning condensation, what is the ratio between the diameter of the charge rod and the diameter of the external cylindrical volume in which the rod is embedded. So for example, if you have a solution of many actin filaments, you could say that each filament is inside some kind of tube whose diameter is the average distance, lateral distance between filaments. And then you could use the same arguments that you use for Manning.
I guess I understand that if there's no salt, but in the presence of salt, nothing happens beyond the screening length.
So then you can say that the screening length defines your diameter of the cell, and then of course when the screening length is very small, you cannot use the bare Manning picture.
I don't think this is essentially is there a dimensionless group that tells you when two surfaces
So you have the what is called the plasma parameter. So if you look at the so what happens if the surface is highly charged, then you would expect the counterions to adsorb at a very narrow layer. So the first thing you need the Gouy-Chapman length, which characterizes the width of this layer, to be very small. The next thing you need is the energy between neighboring counterions in this two-dimensional layer to be much larger than KT. And this is determined by the plasma parameter of this two-dimensional layer of counterions. So this can tell you whether correlations will be important in this layer. And then the range of the interaction will be determined by the lateral distance between charges. Okay. So in the case of DNA, since DNA is flexible on global scales, the kind of compact aggregate that it will form would be of the form of a torus. While in the case of actin, typically it will aggregate into bundles. But in a moment, I will show you also very nice pictures of Jay Tang and Paul Janmi with this, which shows that actin can also form toruses, actually, or rings, rather. So, So this is just to demonstrate to you that DNA is very, very long. So this is a bacteriophage. So this is, which is a virus that attacks bacteria. And originally it was contained in this small volume whose diameter is of the order of 50 nanometers. And once it was, once it got out of this kind of capsid, it went all over the place. This is a single DNA molecule. And you can see that on the scale of 50 nanometer, the filament is smooth, but on larger scale, it is flexible. And here you can see a typical torus. So this torus is composed of three different DNA molecules from three different capsids that were injected into an artificial vesicle in the presence of polyvalent counterions. And so they form this tightly bound torus. These actin loops are just to show you that actin also, although it's very very rigid, if the filament is long enough, it can close on itself in the form of loops. These loops are due to divalent counterions, while these one are due to a specific protein that binds to actin. These rings do not have more than one loop. So if you only have if you only close over a finite section, it's easier to form this connection because
they just ran out of
closed
and
zippered. It's hard to tell. I believe those are probably mostly single rings, a bit of overlap. And one way to tell is that they're approximately as bright as the single filament. I don't know that we ever visualized them in the fault. It's so rare. All of these things are stuck on the surface of the surface. Those filters are coming in the surface.
But the concentration was very low. It was
really low, and they would have to be forming very rapidly.
No, I was very enthusiastic when JSO showed me the paper. It's really nice. But more typically, actin forms bundles, and here you can see side view of bundles that were formed in vitro experiments, which are well controlled. These are actin filaments in the presence of cobalt hexamine, which is a trivalent counterion. And on the right, you see another semi-flexible filament, which is actually a virus, FD virus, which also forms similar bundles in the presence of this trivalent counterion. On the bottom, you see top views of naturally occurring bundles. These bundles occur in inner ear hair cells, and they correspond to different organisms. On the left, this comes from chicken, on the right, from alligator lizard. These systems are much more complicated, and you can see that there are differences in the details. For example, here you can see that each filament has, on the average, 6 neighbors, so there is a local hexagonal order, while here each filament has, on the average, 5 neighbors, so there's a more disordered structure. And also, these bundles are surrounded by a membrane. So the system is much more complex, but nevertheless, you see that there are reasons to believe that there are some unifying features controlling these disaggregation process. The scale bar, which I'm not sure that you can see, is 100 nanometers. So, I lost the scale bar. So there are all these systems, and they seem to be, on one hand, distinct from each other. On the other hand, they have some unifying features. So we started to study this system theoretically, and we start with the most simplest situation where you have only 2 chains. And the question is the following. We have 2 highly charged chains. So they repel each other electrostatically, and they're also semi-flexible, so they have a bending rigidity. And now we add linkers to the solution, and these linkers can have either a physical attraction energy due to electrostatics to the 2 chains, or a short-range chemical interaction. And now the question is, under what conditions these linkers could bring the chains together against their electrostatic repulsion? So the first thing that we will do, we will ask, suppose we have 2 linkers connecting the chains at 2 points, what will be the effective interaction between these 2 linkers due to the presence of these chains? The next thing, we will use this effective interaction, add to it the direct interaction between linkers, and look at the one-dimensional fluid of linkers between the 2 chains. We could calculate the partition function, the free energy, and the binding isotherm of these linkers. And finally, we could compare the free energy of the pair of chains to the free energy of isolated chains and see what are the conditions for aggregation. So in order to calculate the effective interaction between linkers, we assume that the linkers are distributed at equal spaces from each other between the 2 chains. So, and we look at the trial function, which is the simplest periodic function, which is a cosine for the trajectory of the chains. And then we can write the free energy of the 2 chain complex in this structure as function of the distance between linkers, as a sum of the bending energy of the chains and the electrostatic repulsion between the 2 chains. For a fixed interlinker distance, we can minimize this free energy numerically, and in some regimes also analytically, and this will give us an interaction profile of linkers as function of the distance. We assume just the simplest case, because this allows us easily to go from the flat configuration. They are shifted, they are not in the same plane, so they do not exactly fall on top of each other. This allows us to go to the case where they are parallel, one next to the other, to the situation where when they are very far from each other, the two linkers are decoupled from each other, the two neighboring linkers. It's just a simple. Not necessarily. I mean, when they are very far, when they are far away, you would expect to have a circular trajectory, which has a uniform curvature. Yes, and they are shifted from each other, and also we assume that the system is symmetric. So,
solvers have no chirality themselves, right?
No. No, but in fact, we try to see whether having kind of a twist will increase or decrease the free energy, and it has higher energy. Yes, I mean, if it's not due to the intrinsic helicity, but due to the fact that you add the degree of freedom, but then you have to bend the chain more in order that one chain will go below the other. Only when the distance between linkers is much larger than the persistent length, you have larger fluctuations and different trajectories, but this can actually be included. So let me explain to you what happens with these pipe cleaners. Suppose we have an isolated linker, then the two chains prefer to be perpendicular to each other. Now, if we add another linker, the chains will want to be perpendicular also in the other place, and they have to bend in between. Now, if you bring the two linkers closer to each other, you need to further bend the chains or deviate from 90 degrees, and this means that you have to pay energy for doing that. So, if you look at the interaction profile as function of the distance between linkers, at large distances you see a repulsion that increases with bending rigidity. But now something very interesting happens at close distances. So if you have each of these junctions has an electrostatic energy gamma associated with this junction. So we start with a situation where the electrostatic energy is 2 gamma. But now as the distance between linkers goes below the screening length, the electrostatic energy goes down from 2 gamma to 1 gamma. So by bringing the linkers together, you can gain energy because basically they start sharing the same junction. And this leads to this attraction that you see at short distances.
Why do you need to have the screen length? I mean, you just basically don't have to bend the chain between the two. That's why I forget to read it.
Okay, so if you have...
Very close together, you don't have to bend now.
But, what happens is that two things happen. First, when the distance between the linkers goes below the persistent length, the chains do not bend anymore. Then you have two straight chains, and you have a distribution of linkers between them. And now, in order to balance the electrostatic repulsion between the two chains, the linkers prefer to be closer to each other to increase the attractive interaction. Yes.
What's the relevance of it? It looks like a purely mechanical calculation, that is, in which you are balancing bending energy against electrostatics, but there's no entropy associated with fluctuations of the chain. Is that a correct characterization?
Yes, the entropy you can add afterwards at large distances. This calculation will be valid when the distance between linkers is of the order of the persistent length. So fluctuations around the most probable trajectory are small.
Okay, so if the two dominant energies are the bending energy and the electrostatics, with dominant free energies rather than in some sense bending energy and entropy, then I would have thought that the persistence length wouldn't enter the problem at all, because the resistance length is the dimensionless ratio of that energy to KT.
So, in fact, something interesting happens. At close distances, once the distance between linkers go beyond the persistent length, the persistent length dominates the problem, the chains become straight, and the result is independent of the persistent length. It all only depends on electrostatics.
When you said when they're less than the persistence length?
Yes.
Okay, so that's when when the linkers are separated by less than the persistence length,
There are two regimes. One regime is dominated by electrostatics, and the other regime is dominated by bending energy. And the strange thing is that when persistent length dominates, the result is independent of the persistent length, and when electrostatics dominate, the result is independent of electrostatics. So, when the distance is large, the chains, the electrostatics dominate, so the junctions are 90 degree junctions.
Okay, but this by large, you don't mean large compared to the persistence length, because the mechanical problem doesn't know that there is a persistence length.
Okay, there's a crossover distance where the bending energy is comparable to the electrostatic energy.
Right, which is some other way.
I express the bending energy in units of KT.
So KT
But this is just because the other energies dominate over the fluctuations. You still have temperature in the problem. It does not affect this specific calculation, but it will enter later.
Okay, but you would expect all of your answers to be independent of KT, unless you have to rescale them by KT. Therefore, the crossover between the two is
I measure electrostatic energies in units of KT. This gives me the Bjerrum length.
Okay.
And I measure a bending rigidity in units of KT, and this gives me the persistent length. So you could say, okay, I multiply back by KT and I compare electrostatic energies with bending energies. But it's easier to think about the length scales, just because it's easier to visualize.
I'll let you continue, but every time you say something, and then I can compare something to KT, I jump, because KT shouldn't appear in the problem.
Okay, but it will appear in the next... Because this is just to estimate the interaction between two linkers. Now these linkers, they form a one-dimensional fluid, and their entropy is important. So.
If you are interacting, you have not divided the energy by two.
Yes.
Your length and not.
Yes. Okay.
What is L
naught? L naught is the distance where the free energy of interaction at this close distance is the asymptotic free energy of interaction at very large distances.
There is
entropy hidden inside the electrostatic interaction because there is screening of electrostatic interactions. So the screening length depends on temperature, actually. In the absence of screening, there will be no temperature.
Okay.
what is L0 in terms of the parameter of the filter?
L0 is just the length scale that characterizes this this decay, the range of this attractive interaction.
There isn't a simple expression.
There is actually, for L0, there is actually. And then there is another length scale, L star, which is the length scale where, when the bending energy is comparable to the electrostatic energy. Little d is the size of a junction. So it's the chain distance at the junction. Yes, it's the center to center distance.
It's kappa.
Okay, sorry. Kappa is the inverse screening length. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the critical thing is the length at which you balance energy, bending energy against electrostatics, is L star, which is what?
So here I don't have a very simple. Basically, it's the regime where LP over L star will be comparable to gamma, because gamma is the measure of the electrostatic. Gamma is. Gamma is the energy, electrostatic energy of one junction at 90 degrees. So in units of KT, it will be 2 pi psi squared e to the minus kappa d over kappa LD. And for DNA, for example, it will be of the order of 12 KT. In fact, L star can be calculated by analytically by looking at small deviations from a straight line. So you expand to lowest order, and I have some approximate expressions for that. So now. We have this effective interaction, which was calculated in kind of a ground state approximation, and this is the effective interaction between two linkers. And to this we can add the direct interaction between linkers that can be either short-range excluded volume interaction or long-range screen-Coulomb interaction. And also we can take into account the entropy of these kind of loops when the distance between linkers is much larger than the persistent length. So that would be the dominant term at very large distances. And although this does not modify the shape of the how the results look like, it was shown in another context of DNA denaturation that this long-range term can modify the can make the transition that occurs in the system a first-order phase transition. I will show it in a moment. There's an important approximation here is we assume that the interaction between these two neighboring linkers is independent of the interaction between these two neighboring linkers. This approximation is good when the distance is large, because then the junctions become 90 degrees and are decoupled from each other. And it's also good at close distances, where when the chains are parallel and there's basically no real dependence on the position. And it's only in the intermediate regime where this becomes is in fact an approximation. But when we assume that they are decoupled from each other, it means that the position function breaks into a single loop transportation functions, and it can be calculated exactly. And then one can calculate the binding isotherm of the linkers into the two chains. So the situation that we are thinking of is we have two chains in a solution of linkers. The linkers have a fixed concentration. This concentration fixes their chemical potential. And here we plot as function of the chemical potential of the linkers in the solution the density of linkers between the two chains. And small chemical potentials correspond to low concentrations of linkers, and large chemical potentials correspond to high concentrations. At low chemical potentials, the density of linkers between the two chains is low. This means that the linkers are far from each other. The chains cross each other at 90 degrees and form large loops in between. Then, as we reach a certain critical chemical potential, mu star, there is a sharp jump in the density of linkers, and we move into the dense regime, where the chains are more or less parallel to each other, and the linkers are closely packed, but since it's a one-dimensional system, they are disordered. So this is the regime that we call the disordered railway track. In between, we have a crossover regime. So the model is one-dimensional, so we don't have a true discontinuity and a true phase transition. But since the two chains are embedded in three-dimensional space and are extruded volume interactions, we believe that in a real system, this would be a phase transition. Nevertheless, we have this intermediate regime, and in this intermediate regime, there are large fluctuations in distances between linkers, which correspond to the formation of clusters of linkers separated by large loops. And we think that this intermediate regime should come just before, for example, the bundling transition of filaments. Now, if we calculate the free energy of the system and we compare the free energy of the two-chain complex to the free energy of isolated chains, we find that below a certain point, rho star, the two-chain complex is unstable. So the dilute regime, in the dilute regime, the two chains will just break apart. They will not hold together. In a many-chain system, this will correspond to a network, and then the chains will stay close to each other because they are already in the semi-dilute regime, while this will correspond to the bundle regime.
So
here we calculate the fluctuations in the distance between linkers, and these fluctuations become very large. So you can have it's kind of like a coexistence between the dilute regime and the dense regime. So you have these clusters, and then you have these large loops. What? So in this intermediate regime, all energies are quite comparable. So if the chain is infinite, entropy will favor having a large distribution of clusters. So I mean, because this is a thermodynamic calculation that shows that you do have large fluctuations. So I think these clusters are kind of an intrinsic property of the system.
In the calculation, which is a kind of one-D Ising model, you have some correlation length, which is always finite, but it has to be kind of enormous in the quantum edge approach there against it's railway traffic. Like, I'm just thinking that when you have a 1-degree azimuth and lower temperature, you always have coexistence of, you know, up and down regions. But the correlation rate blows up as you approach counter temperature. Something similar was happening here.
Yeah, I would. I think that the correlation length would be basically 1/density, but I'm not sure. We don't calculate it directly from the model, the correlation length.
And it's probably an exponential free energy cost of one of those loops compared to free energy of the density.
What we do see is kind of a reminiscence of a divergence in the second derivative, in the fluctuation, basically. Yeah.
Does it show a finite size?
Yes.
And the filaments have a finite size?
Yeah.
Is there some kind of special regime where the sizes are matched, or is there an optimal size?
The energies depend on the size of the, of actually the sum of the size of the linker and the size of the chains. We make an approximation which assumes that it is fixed, while in fact, in practice, I mean, the chains can kind of change the distance a little bit.
But the density of those river effect things depends on the size of the linker, but not the filament.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so in fact, as you increase the concentration of linkers in solution, they will tend to dense, to pack more and more densely. And now it depends what is the direct interaction between linkers. So this will dominate at short distances. And if they are charged, they will be less a pack than if they are only hardcore interactions. In this calculation, yes, but we also did it for divalent and trivalent counterions. And in a moment, I will show some molecular dynamic simulations of a model system that is related. I don't know, but also, I mean, if you assume that the chain length is fixed, then the linkers can probably adjust to the monomers. But maybe they compete. If you have magnesium, then it participates both in the polymerization and in the cross-linking. So, I mean, the dynamics can be very interesting. So to kind of compare to the model, or rather Kunshun has been running molecular dynamic simulations, and this is a system which is in some sense more simple than ours because it's a finite chain, but in another sense it's more complicated because it has electrostatic interactions explicitly without screening, without any approximations. So what we have in the simulations is basically two charged chains, each consisting of 64 charged monomers in red. And these monomers are, the charge on the monomers is balanced by a mixture of monovalent counterions in blue and trivalent counterions in green. And there are no co-ions in the system, no screening. Now, we change the composition of monovalent versus trivalent counterions, and we look how the system equilibrates. When the number of trivalent counterions is low, the chains do not form an aggregate, and they stay apart, until a certain point where the 1/3 of the charge on the chains is balanced by the trivalent counter ion, and then the chains start to complexate. Now, they complexate over a finite length. So, and the trivalent counter ion are mostly in this paired section. Now, as you increase the number of trivalent counter ions in solution, the overlap length between the chains increases, while the density of linkers remains fixed. This is like the lever rule when you have a coexistence between two phases. So this continues until the two chains fully overlap. Then the density will continue to increase a little bit as the linkers crowd, but then eventually they will start popping out and the density will saturate. And this can be seen here. Here you see the length of the shared section as function of the number of trivalent counter ions. And on the bottom, this is the density of linkers. You see that the shared length increases linearly and then saturates, while the density is fixed and then increases and saturates. The structure of the counter ions in this shared length is a fluid-like structure, so there is one peak and then a secondary peak in the correlation function, but there are no additional peaks. This is the density of polyvalent counter ions in the shared section, per the linear density.
That's this constant as the amount of size of those things.
As the overlap length, as they increase the overlap. So, to summarize this part, what we have seen is that if we look at the effective interaction between the linkers due to the presence of the chains, we see that there is a repulsion at large distances due mostly to the bending rigidity, and there's a short-range attraction which is due to the electrostatic repulsion between the chains, and there's this barrier in between which is responsible for a very interesting behavior in the phase behavior of the linker fluid, which has kind of a rounded phase transition from the dilute regime, which is like a two-dimensional network, to the dense regime, which is like a two-dimensional bundle. And this transition is accompanied by large fluctuations, clusters, and large loops. We hope eventually to be able to extend this model to the many-chain system to understand better the transition between networks and bundles. So now the question is, how much time could they spend on the rigid rods? Okay. So I think it won't be that long. So one of the main things that came up of the model is the fact that as you increase the number of linkers, you move from a situation where the chains are perpendicular to each other to a situation where the chains are parallel to each other. And we see something very similar in the system where we have rigid rods. And let me put this first. So this study was motivated by experiments done by Safinia Wong and Lee here in Santa Barbara, where they take actin filaments at a concentration where they are in the nematic phase. And this is a phase where the concentration is such that when the rods rotate freely, they start bumping into each other, and then they can gain translational entropy by sacrificing some of their rotational entropy, so they become more or less parallel to one direction, and then they don't bump into each other that much, and they can translate much more freely. I don't remember the numbers, but it has to be above. So the critical concentration goes like 1 over L squared D, when L is the length and D is the diameter. I don't remember, but you don't have much to play with, because if you go too much, you have about a factor 2 or 3, because then you have the smectic phase. So this... because of polydispersity. No, I don't know. I can ask Cyrus. So what they did was they started with this pneumatic phase, and then they started adding linkers, which were a polyvalent counterions in this case. And if you add a large number of polyvalent counterions, you see bundles. But then in intermediate regimes or intermediate amounts of linkers, they saw something that looked like a network, but they were not sure what exactly are the characteristics of this network. So the question that we want to address is what kind of structure you want you expect to see in this regime. So in order to do that, we have first to understand what drives the pneumatic transition of the actin in the first place. And this theory is due to Onsager, and it's a classical theory, which is due only to excluded volume. Now, if you look at two rigid rods at a fixed angle from each other, they are not free to occupy every point in space. There is a joint excluded volume, which has the shape of a parallelogram, whose volume goes like the length of the rods squared multiplied by the diameter and the angle between the rods. So when the rods are perpendicular, this angle is large, and when they are parallel, this joint volume is small. And this excluded volume is plotted here in yellow. And now when the density increases beyond the inverse of this volume, so when the density multiplied by this Onsager volume dl squared is of the order of 1, you have this phase transition, because you prefer the rods to be parallel. In terms of the volume fraction, this is interesting, because the volume fraction is only of the order of d over l, which is the aspect ratio of the rods. So it occurs at relatively low volume fractions. And another an important point that I have to say is that this theory is correct in the limit where this aspect ratio is very small. So very thin, long rods. The same theory applies also for semi-flexible chains if you take the persistent length to be the effective length of a chain. So now we want to take the pneumatic phase and add linkers. So what happens is the following. So suppose the filaments are charged and you add the linker, then the rods would like to be perpendicular to each other because of the electrostatic repulsion. But now the problem is that one rod would be, for example, parallel to the pneumatic direction, where all the rods are oriented. Then the other rod will be perpendicular to this direction, and the rods will keep bumping into it, so there will be an excluded volume or rather a depletion volume surrounding this transverse rod. And this depletion volume is shown here in gray. So in order to create this depletion volume, you have to push the rods out of this volume against osmotic pressure of the solution. This can be calculated within the Onsinger theory, and it is about 30 kT. So you gain the energy of adsorbing the linker to the two rods. You pay the electrostatic repulsion between the two rods, but you also pay a very high price for creating this depletion volume. But then, if you want to have another junction, the obvious thing to do would be to put the two junctions next to each other so that the depletion volumes overlap, because then you will not pay that much for pushing the other rods out of this depletion volume. And no, it is within the second viral coefficient. Okay, it's a free body effect. The two objects or the two impurities are different. They are not. It's not a phase of impurities that I'm looking at. So you look at the pneumatic phase in the presence of these two impurities, the two rods. That the transverse rods are not basically part of the of the pneumatic phase.
It's right. Okay, so in order to get the depletion interaction, you have to look at two objects, not just in isolation, but in the presence of some third object whose excluded volume is reduced when their depletion volume is overlapped.
Yes. Yeah. People did similar calculations with spheres in pneumatic phases. There are all these experiments on chains of spheres and similar systems.
The reason I'm asking is that so the original Onsager theory ignores effects like that. It's strictly a virial extension.
Yeah.
And he argued that because the transition occurred at such low concentrations, that was adequate. That you just go to second order concentration without taking into account further depletion interactions between specific rods. Is there what I was trying to understand is why. Is there a reason, qualitative reason, why it's necessary to go beyond that approximation here, whereas it wasn't just the rods?
There's another thing. It's the fact that for the Onsinger theory, the aspect ratio has to be very large. So the ratio between the length and the diameter have to be large. These objects are slightly different.
Right.
You can view them maybe as plates.
Okay, so if I had done some more isotropic object like spheres, the second variable expansion would be completely adequate.
Yeah. Here you can see examples of how these depletion volumes overlap. So the pneumatic director goes in this direction, and so if the two transverse rods are only partially overlapped, there will be a force that will push them to be exactly one on top of the other. And if you look from an up view, if there will be a finite angle between them, there will be a torque that will rotate them so that they will be parallel to each other. And one can calculate these forces as function of distance between transverse rods using the Onsager theory at short distances of the order of the length of the rods. And one can use order parameter theory to calculate this similarly the interaction at larger distance, which is much larger than the distance between rods. And the main result is that you have attraction between these transverse rods. And you remember that I told you that basically behind each of these transverse rods is a linker. So basically what we do here is we calculate the effective interaction between linkers due to the presence of the rods, which is somewhat similar to what we have been doing with the flexible chains. And the important thing is that there is this attraction which has a depth of about 30 kT and has a long range. So even if these transverse rods will be very far from each other, they will feel each other and they will start to aggregate. And they would like to aggregate in an anisotropic way. That is, they prefer to aggregate in a direction which is parallel to the pneumatic director. That is the orientation of the other rods. And so you would expect to see some kind of long ribbons forming in the pneumatic phase, what we called a raft, because it looks like these rafts that you put on a river. And each of these rafts is basically a two-dimensional network, where the angle between rods is 90 degrees. Then these rafts can stack one on top of the other, and this is due to interactions between surfaces inside the pneumatic phase, and they will accumulate in kind of a stack of rafts. So we do not calculate the free energy of this structure, but we just show that there is a mechanism by which such an anisotropic structure can form. This is not the only structure that one could think of. One could also think that since the rods prefer to be at 90 degrees, you will have some kind of cubatic network where you have rods going in the three main directions, and the linkers connecting rods at 90 degrees. This cubatic phase is a superposition of basically three pneumatic phases in the three main directions. And this structure and similar ones comes out of a generalization of the Onsager theory, where you take into account this tendency of rods to be at 90 degrees and the fact that it competes with the tendency to be parallel to each other. However, such a structure is not consistent with what is observed in experiments, and therefore we think that this structure might be kind of a kinetic trap that the system is drawn into, and the question remains open whether, if you wait with the long enough, the system will anneal from this structure to this one. Yes, which is unclear yet.
No.
This is something that we don't know yet. C is what you get from the Onsager theory, with some variations. Yes. I mean, you can show, what you can show is that so you have two contributions to the effective angle-dependent interaction between rods. One is the fact that they want to be parallel because of extruded volume, but they also want to be perpendicular because of the electrostatic torque. And you can show that beyond a certain regime, you will switch from the pneumatic to a structure like this. And there are also, I mean, there's the phlebatic and the tetratic, which has some slight variations from each other, but basically you have something like this. Yes. So what, in fact, this will lead to precipitation, which is what, as I understand, is what they see in the experiment.
It's actually really, really strange. Those things are also going to be rheologically really different.
Yeah.
And we do see, in a way that's not completely reproducible, a tremendous increase in rigidity starts to move in divalent counter ions, stickers into short active filaments, basically pretty much like with Girard. By scattering, we don't always get it. Sometimes you get, nothing. Sometimes you get these enormously rigid structures that are perfectly isolated. I mean, often they're just beautifully clear.
Uh-huh.
Any kind of heterogeneity. So sometimes you don't. And I guess those are two close energy states. So maybe that, some experimental variable that you from one to the other.
The pneumatic setup, when it's a fully three dimensional phase, the original phase diagram is, does it have a wide region of phase separation from the pneumatic phase? As you've got a three component system, there's certainly a possibility for real phase coexistence. That would be more, another source of heterogeneity. It's just the coexistence of one of these phases.
Yeah. I don't remember how large was the coexistence regime. One thing is that, just a small comment, in the phlebatic phase, all directions are equally equivalent, and there are all kinds of variations. In the tetratic phase, one direction is more probable than the other, so there's some asymmetry building up. And in fact, here, what happens is that one direction goes to zero, basically. So it might be that a different approach might give some. One might be able to check this also with an ulcer field.
So one starts with a bunch of rods, the dome linkers that are below the isotropic pneumatic transition. You have an isotropic phase of rods. As you add linkers, does it necessarily go pneumatic before going to one of these other phases, or might the linkers drive it directly? It's a cubatic network. Well, it looks like a network.
Yeah.
I might interpret that as a version of
isotropic phase. So if you are below, so you have the regime which you, the pneumatic transition happens at 1/L², basically. 1/L². Then you have 1/L³, which is where you have overlap. So now if you start adding linkers, then you'll have some kind of percolation problem. And now the question is when you will have a gel, and this is the system that Eric Sackmann was working on.
Part of your point is when you add linkers, the system doesn't have to remain isotropic as fast as the linkers.
Or, yeah.
Maybe it refers to because it actually likes to have the things at angles.
It depends on the amount of linkers. So at first, the osmotic pressure of the linkers is not large enough to bring many linkers together to hold filaments perpendicular to each other. Because you have a very long filament, you need to have many linkers to glue them together. And you can only do that if you have a high concentration of linkers in solution. So if you have intermediate concentrations, then it's just that whenever the rods come close to each other, you have a higher probability to draw a linker to this area, and then it will tend to stay there for some time. Yes. Yeah. Let me. Yeah, I'm not sure I have this on transparency, but it can go to a lower concentration. No, okay. I don't, but yeah. So when we talked with him, they didn't have the microscope images yet. So I haven't talked with him yet, so I don't know. Basically, the osmotic pressure of the rods in the pneumatic phase that will push them together, and because it's kind of a depletion, it's again a depletion interaction on a higher level, and then the closest distance depends on the interaction between the layers themselves. A little bit more, because so the rods that are inside these they can still kind of fluctuate. So I would say a little bit more. And also the I think they were at least planning to. This will also have very interesting rheological properties, because each of the three directions is different. You have the plate sliding on with respect to each other, and then you have the perpendicular to the plates, and then you have the direction which is parallel to the pneumatic director. Yes. Or you have to be close to the. So if you are in the isotropic, you still have this extruded volume interaction. You still pay the price, but the penalty is proportional to how close you are to the pneumatic transition naturally. So if you are close but below, you will have this extruded volume interaction, but then it won't be it will be isotropic. So you could have some kind of clusters growing, some kind of disordered area with network of linkers growing in the solution, but it will be disordered. So the cubatic is obtained by a free energy minimization. So you see that you can get a minimum of the free energy at a regime where without linkers you wouldn't have the pneumatic phase. With here, there's just the mechanism. The mechanism relies on the presence of the. Yes. No. But
I imagine if you make to keep the concentration of linkers constant, you just make more and more rows. Starting from the cubatic, you can also get the spectra because you can detect more easily. Still maintain a high concentration of linkers, right? Well, that's not a problem if you increase the density of rows. So, I mean, anyhow, the RAF shouldn't be. I mean, if you're talking about mechanism, that's one thing, but equilibrium or not.
Stat RAFs basically relies on the existence of some osmotic pressure. It occurs under some thermodynamic conditions, corresponding to some osmotic pressure for water. And what you can think of that physically is saying the whole thing is that a big dialysis bag is being pushed together by the osmotic pressure. Whatever the reservoir is.
I suppose you just consider the density of roads to, I don't know, it's very close, I don't know, 50% or whatever, I'm exaggerating, 10% or whatever.
This is not that dense, because...
Well, you can make it dense. Okay.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's...
One direction is very dense, and then the other two directions.
But because in the plane, it's a network.
Okay. Yeah, but it's denser than the cubatic, unless you try to...
Yes.
It can be denser if... Of course,
yeah.
You can make the
bucket
more dense, but you have to add more linkers.
No, it'll always be dense. Your point is that there's a depletion. You have a macroscopic graph, and it has a depletion attraction with another macroscopic graph. Total attraction between two large objects is always going to be much greater than 18. So once you form ramps, how thick are you going to remove them?
And they do that. So these are myosin filaments? Okay. I look for them.
But the density of those stack graphs is always higher than the cubatic density.
I think so, because the typical distance between the layers will be larger than the typical mesh size.
All my friends,
Yeah. The short range order that they see.